Welcome to the Ethics Experts, where we're elevating ethics and compliance and HR to the strategic level it's supposed to be.
3, 2, 1, and we're live. Welcome to the Ethics Experts, everyone. We're here with Charlie Middleton. Charlie, welcome.
Hi, welcome.
Thank you so much for joining us today. You are someone who I met on LinkedIn, somebody who has a similar heart that I have for whistleblowers. And I spend a lot of time reading your articles about whistleblowers and the blackballing thing. And we're just excited to get you on here to share not only your background, but also your perspective on this issue that I think is, it's not talked about enough, you know, shocking, right? And I think it's something that can really provide some really big gains for organizations if they can get it right from a cultural standpoint.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's very easy to get extremely frustrated when you see the bad things happening in the world and the slow pace of change. I always try to take a step back and go, you know, hey, 100 years ago there was slavery, right? So, you know, the pace of change is actually rapid, right? And the horrible things you see happening are lingering effects of, but they are fixable. Right. And we just need to take some steps to fix them.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think when you put it in that perspective, that it was only 100 years ago, and you even look back 50 years and the changes that have been made from a social justice perspective, or even the last 20 years, right, as sort of the playing field has been leveled. Some of these things that maybe our grandparents thought would never change, we see have totally changed. But it's going to take that continual pressure on these things that we still feel there are injustices around in order for that change to continue unabated.
Right. I just did the math in my head. Actually, 150 years ago, there was slavery.
But it feels like 100. Okay.
Right.
So maybe we can start where, how did this become a hot button issue for you? Or how did this become something that you felt you needed to advocate for?
Well, so I can only talk so much about details because of, you know,
sure.
with prior employers. But, you know, I think that there's a kind of a personality type that when they see something that bothers them, they can't drop it, right? A reasonable thing to do when you're a corporate employee with a good job and you see something bad the company's doing is to ask about it and see how people respond and read the tea leaves, right? If you can tell if you're making people uncomfortable, right? And most people take the hint, right? And sure, we're inflating our earnings, but you know, that's the accountants say it's okay.
Everyone does it.
Everyone does it, right? Sure, we're cheating on our taxes, but look, you know, we've got a legal opinion that says it's cool. You know, yes, if you read this document, it makes it sound like we're lying, but you know, so I mean, people rationalize, right? And they don't make a fuss, and they don't make themselves into a problem. But there's a certain whistleblower sort of mentality, I think, is, you know, for better or worse, they keep asking the question. You know, really, we're pouring these pollutants into the water? I mean, I can't get comfortable with that. You know, the cows are dying, right? There's elementary schools down, you know, stream or whatever, right? You know, there's a lot of examples of companies doing bad things, right? These are good people doing bad things, right? And, you know, someone needs to put their hand up, but generally when somebody puts their hand up, you kind of, the rule of the mob, you know, applies, right? Oh, you're a school pigeon, right? You know, we're turning.
Yeah, you're a rat.
An enemy, you know?
Right. So you brought up a couple interesting points, and you brought up this personality type thing. And I wonder from your standpoint, do you think it's, I mean, personality types are always on this sort of spectrum. And I feel like there's probably some people on this sort of whistleblower spectrum, let's call it, who they're going to speak up regardless, right? And no matter what the culture is or no matter what the pushback is, they're going to speak up and they're going to say, hey, this is not right and this doesn't sit well with me. But then there's other people that are maybe more toward the middle that are still on that sort of whistleblower spectrum, but they respond more to the social pressures or whatever. Has that been sort of your experience? And what do you think folks can do to help, you know, not get silenced or help make sure that people have a voice?
Well, so yeah, I agree with you about the spectrum thing. And that's why I kind of call myself an accidental whistleblower, right? I didn't set out to become a whistleblower. I as a matter of fact, I think being a whistleblower is a bad idea for the individual.
Like right? functionally, yeah.
It's not, you know, the risk reward is bad, right? So I live in West Palm Beach. So across the water, there's Palm Beach, right? And there's house, you know, 10, 50, $100 million house after $50 million house, right? So there's a lot of wealth, right? And so one of the things that people say about whistleblowers is, oh, there are these whistleblower reward programs, you're in it for the money. Well, if you're in it for the money, you're an idiot, right?
Yeah.
Because, corporate executives get rich, CEOs get rich, CFOs get rich, whistleblowers, not so much.
Yeah, who is someone who has generational wealth from blowing a whistle?
Yeah, one guy I can think of, Bradley Birkenfeld.
Okay, fine. The exception proves the rule, though, kind of.
Right, yeah. I mean, literally, it doesn't happen.
Right.
So, I mean, I think that, you know, when you're evaluating whether or not you should be a whistleblower, the right decision is probably don't do it. But I don't think that's really how it works out, right? You don't say, gosh, should I become a whistleblower? You see something wrong that's happening in your job, and you're like, gosh, I should tell my boss, right? You know, first off, companies are telling you to tell your boss, and you it seems like you're doing the right thing, and you are doing the right thing, but
it comes from here. It doesn't come from here, or it doesn't come from, I'm pointing to my pocketbook. It comes from something in your stomach or something from your heart that causes those people to do it. And I think that's totally contrary to your point. It's totally contrary to this sort of like monetary pursuit that whistleblowers often get labeled with. It's just kind of an interesting.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's not an economically rational decision, but I tend to think that the people who are wired that way don't really have a choice, right? They don't really, I mean, in my particular case, when I was in law school, and then I found out how much money practicing lawyers make, and I thought, gosh, why would you keep doing that every year? Wouldn't you just do that for a year and then take 2 or 3 years off and have fun and then do it for a year? No one needs that much money.
Right.
Then when you're a practicing lawyer, you're like, you know, all of a sudden you've got a huge house and yada, 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 and all of a sudden you do need that much money. But I mean, so my point is that, you know, people don't make rational decisions about money anyway. Right.
Right.
So you don't think when you're telling your boss, hey, we shouldn't pollute that river, you're not thinking, this might jeopardize my career and I won't be able to provide for my family. But in some cases, that is very true. Right? I mean, if you go to the National Whistleblower Center and you look at the profiles of a bunch of the whistleblowers, there are people who, you know, have not been able to work for 17 years, right? A guy's in the financial service industry, and then he's a janitor. There's a great quote, and I can't remember the guy's name, but, you know, if somebody said, would you do it again? And he said, you mean put my children in poverty? You mean they couldn't, you know, we couldn't take vacations. We couldn't, you know, they couldn't go to private schools. They couldn't pay for the college they wanted to go to. Would I do that again? Of course not. Right? I'd have to be a cruel person. No, I wouldn't do it again.
Which is just such a crazy thing because, again, at the core, again, let's push aside the stereotype, which I don't even think is actually sort of substantiated. To your point, there's like one guy who's made money doing it. Mm-hmm. At the core, it's based on this sort of visceral reaction to something that just doesn't sit well. It feels wrong. I feel like I need to say something about it. And yet it leads to this sort of counterintuitive outcome because, you know, we all like to think that, hey, everyone's good and everyone's sort of trying to do their best and so forth. But there's just this really weird disconnect in this area that I still can't really wrap my head around. Mm. And, you know, what a picture of a guy who has earning potential in the hundreds of thousands of dollars who's sweeping floors now because he stood up and did the right thing. Like, this is America. That's not supposed to happen here. And yet it does. Yet the National Whistleblower Center has hundreds of stories of folks like this. It's crazy.
Right. And the movie of the week never goes that way, right? You know, if you're idealistic, you're like, hey, I'm doing the right thing. Good things are going to come from it, right? But, you know, that's not reality, right? The reality is that it generally ends badly for the whistleblower. But, you know, I mean, in my case, for example, right, I'm not destitute, right? For me, the biggest price has been not being able to do the job which I enjoy doing, right? I mean, you know, traveling around the world and working on deals and, you know, doing mergers and acquisitions, it's fun, right?
Right.
I mean, you know, sure, of course you love, you know, taking the kids to school and stuff, but, you know, I mean, after a while, yeah, it gets old.
There's a balance there, okay? Right. Yeah, that's fulfilling in a way, but it's not, it doesn't provide the challenging fulfillment that, you know, the stuff you just talked about provides, right? That sort of cutting edge and, hey, I'm doing something new and I'm sharpening my sword and I'm getting exposed to these things. And I think you touched on it. It's like everyone's idealistic and everybody thinks if you do the right thing, you get the right outcomes. But in this particular area, folks get totally blackballed. And I'd love to kind of dive into this blackball thing some more to, you know, I can't wrap my head around it because so in the business I'm in, we're kind of built on this. We're built on whistleblowing and so forth. And to me, it's kind of a sign of a good culture. If somebody speaks up, I want a culture. I want my team to speak up if they see something wrong because we're united in terms of what we want, or at least in theory, we're united in terms of, hey, we want to create this type of an environment. But there's some kind of disconnect between the words and the actions at some of these larger organizations where the real kind of blackballing occurs that's sort of crippling potentially to somebody's career. And I just would love if you can kind of dive into that or speak to that a little bit more, because you're so much closer to this thing and your writings are so kind of prolific on this issue from many different angles.
Yeah, I think that there's two points that I'd like to make. The first is that when we say blackballing, you think of some, you know, nefarious list of, you know, where companies go and they check to see whether the guy's on the bad list. You know, obviously that's not how it is.
Mm-hmm.
The way it really is somebody works at a company, they raise their hand about an issue. The company says, we're going to investigate the issue. But really what they're thinking is, this guy's a problem, right? And then the person gets fired for something else, right? Oh, you cheated on your expense report or something, right? They cook something up, right? Retaliation, right? They're not dumb enough to say, we're firing you for reporting us for fraud, right?
Right.
So then the person needs to find another job. And so you go on an interview. And they say, well, you know, why'd you leave your last job? Well, do you say, because I reported the company for fraud? And that's a bad move, right? I mean, they're going to say, oh, you're not a team player. You know, you're a bad guy. So you say, I felt it was time to move on. Or, you know, I didn't have a good relationship with my boss and I recognized that was an error and I won't do it again. Or whatever you say. But regardless, they'll call and check up on you, right? So the big companies... Every big company has a relationship with every big four accounting firm, mm-hmm. and a bunch of law firms. So if your auditor is Deloitte and you talk to somebody at Deloitte, and the hiring company does, and the Deloitte partner calls the Deloitte partner for the company that you last worked for, and that conversation will be honest, right? I mean, these are two guys who work for a consulting firm. They're going to be honest with each other. And you know, the guy at the old company will say, well, you know, Charlie was not a team player, right? He didn't get along very well with so-and-so. He had a problem with some things, you know, these kind of like negative feedbacks, or, you know, might even just come out and say it. He's a whistleblower, you know, stay away from him. So then the partner who's at the hiring firm is going to tell the truth to his client. And, you know, so I don't really think of it as being particularly nefarious, right? These are people who are telling the truth about something that is material about a candidate, right? I have a hard time faulting that. What I don't like is this decision by the hiring company to say, okay, we're not going to hire that person because given the choice between a troublemaker and a non-troublemaker, we're going to hire the non-troublemaker, right? We're just not going to hire the whistleblower.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. So, yeah, I mean, you just touched on it, and I think it's a framing problem at the corporate level or in the minds of people. And I think nobody likes a tattletale, right? And when you're in junior high, somebody's a tattletale, you don't like that, right? But I think there's sort of two types, maybe, you know, maybe we can break a tattletale. You know, maybe whistleblowers get kind of labeled as tattletales, and maybe they're really two different things. You know, a tattletale is really just focused on trying to get somebody in trouble. Whereas like a whistleblower is really more like something is wrong and I feel like I need to say something about it. I'm not trying to necessarily get somebody in trouble. I am just trying to, you know, there's some cognitive dissonance going on, or there's some dissonance between what I'm seeing and what I think I should be seeing given what I was told about the company, or what I was told about our values or our purpose, or what role I'm supposed to be playing in whatever thing I'm doing. Like one seems to be motivated, you know, the rat or the tattletale seems to be motivated from like a selfish perspective. And it seems like a whistleblower, it's really motivated by more of a selfless perspective.
Yeah. And I think that, I mean, to use your elementary school example, if Johnny, you know, is breaking the rules because he has bubble gum at lunch, come on, don't be a rat.
Right.
But if Johnny stabs Susie in the bathroom, you really need to tell.
Those feel like different things. They're rooted in something different, but it often gets conflated. And, you know, nobody likes a rat, but like, do you want somebody who actually has your back? Right. Like if you're in a foxhole, you want somebody who actually has your back and is actually looking out for you. So how do we change this sort of frame at the corporate level or at the hiring level to look at kind of a whistleblower a little bit differently?
The way that I think it's best framed is, all right, when somebody commits fraud, who gets hurt and who is benefited, right? And so let's say that the fraud is a bribe, right? I'm a dishonest company and I'm paying bribes to a government official so that I'll get a government contract, right? So if the whistleblower tattles, then, you know, the practice is likely to stop and the company is likely to have less business. And so the people at the company are less likely to get their bonuses. So if you're at the company, you might say, I really wish you wouldn't do that. But on the other hand, the honest company, the competitor, now isn't getting the contract. They're better. Their product is better, right? It's cheaper.
Right.
But no, the dishonest company is getting it because they paid the bribe. So the honest company should say, nah, we want to know about bribery. We want to live in a world where there's less bribery because our product is better, right? So I think if the honest company would say, we have a policy, we like to hire whistleblowers, because if you work at the dishonest company and you get fired for whistleblowing, come on over to our side. You know, feel free to blow the whistle, right? Because we're making the world more honest. And we're not afraid of the ramifications. As a matter of fact, we welcome them, because we compete on honesty and competence as opposed to bribery.
Yeah, and you know, what our challenge is, the whole point of this podcast, The Ethics Experts, is to help elevate ethics and compliance folks to this strategic lever that it should be, because they can affect culture directly, whereas, you know, accounting is not going to affect culture, you know, things like that. So how do we communicate this as an actual strategic angle to a board of directors that's maybe more pragmatic, that's not the bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, hey, I'm an idealist. You know, few boards are full of like a bunch of just idealistic people, right? There's, on average, they're more pragmatic. Again, this is a stereotype and a generalization, but it's been my experience that they care about the bottom line and they care about these things. It feels like there's really a strategic angle to the messaging you just said in the marketplace. And it may be generational and maybe like the time is now, but what a powerful thing for a company to say on their website, you know, hey, here's our contact, or, you know, get a job with us page, you know, the job opportunities page, putting that kind of stuff out there. It kind of resonates with the type of ethos that a lot of companies at least put on their wall or put on their website, but it can sort of actually tie it down to an action that gives it that makes it feel more substantial. And that could be a strategic lever. I'm just kind of brainstorming on some ways to like actually make this happen, because I mean, you're talking about people who are trying to do the right thing, people who are trying to make the world a better place. Again, every corporate mission is kind of that, right?
Right.
But the actions, there's some degradation or there's some disintegration between those words on the wall and what's actually happening boots on the ground. So how do we break that down and make guys say, you know what, I want to hire a whistleblower?
Well, my opinion is that if we could just get a couple of truly influential thought leaders or whatever, you know, whatever, Elon Musk or, you know, Zuckerberg or, you know, whatever, Bezos, people who are truly influential. I don't see this coming from boards. and I know this isn't universally true, but in my experience, boards are controlled by management, and they're selected for their job because they're friendly. This internal auditors are paid by management. They're friendly. There's no such thing as an independent anybody who, if you pay me, you're my master, right?
Correct.
And so, you know, if the audit committee or the outside auditor can be replaced when they say something unpopular, they're not truly independent. So I think it's going to have to take their true power, right? The guy who, you know, and there are guys like that, right? There's a handful of them.
Sure.
And I think that if they kind of get this message of a corporate mission statement is almost meaningless, right? You know, we will act with integrity, right? That's extremely powerful if you mean it, and it means nothing if you don't, and you can't tell because everyone says it. So
right.
The difference of behavior between the honest company and the dishonest company is none. Right, so that statement in itself is meaningless. The act of hiring a whistleblower carries a ton of meaning, right? I mean,
it's an action. It's tangible,
action.
Right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, actions speak louder than words, right? And so, I've had a surprisingly hard time communicating that idea to people. Right? People say, "Why should I hire a whistleblower? I should hire the most qualified candidate." And I'm like, well, yeah, you should. That's true.
Yeah, but all else equal, how is that not a tiebreaker to the positive? To your point.
And you're acting as though, you know, that's the dynamic we have. That's not the dynamic we have. The dynamic we have is whistleblowers don't get hired ever. So they are the most qualified person for positions that they're getting passed on for because they're being disqualified. So, you know, yes,
right.
Companies should be able to hire the most qualified person, but they are currently choosing not to hire the whistleblower if they instead chose to hire the whistleblower. And another thing, think how efficient it would be if you hire an internal audit team to find bad stuff at the company, right? Well, how about if you just empowered the people at the company to go, hey, here's some bad stuff, right?
Yeah, it could solve itself, to your point. You don't need your own little sort of internal affairs department, which is effectively what that internal audit team becomes, because
right.
Everyone's got their eye on the ball and have the same sort of heart toward the mission or the purpose or whatever the company's there to do. That's a great idea. I'd love you to talk a little bit about this experience you had reaching out to these 30 companies about this issue.
Yeah. So
that's
so
crazy. I mean, this is like a crazy story.
Well, and so I wrote about it in LinkedIn, but I basically, oh my goodness, I'm getting a cramp. Yikes. Story's so painful. Not really. So I just as kind of as an experiment, I noticed that people in internal audit and internal, you know, controllership roles were not responding to the stuff that I was posting. And people at accounting firms were not responding, right? I was saying, hey, shouldn't the accounting firms do things differently, right? Because as I mentioned before, the accounting firms are a big part of the blackballing infrastructure. I mean, it's not their mission, but that's how it plays out.
Right.
And so I sent, you know, emails via LinkedIn or in-mails or whatever they're called,
mm-hmm.
to 30 partners at all these accounting firms and to a ton of internal audit people, and I got very few responses. I've been noticing how many people unfollow me.
Really?
That action led to unfollowing.
Wow.
You know, people don't want to be reminded, right? I mean, when you go to work, you're not, you know, if you work at some big company, you're not thinking, I'm a dishonest person. You don't think that. That's not your self-image at all, right? Your self-image is, you know, I have an important job. I'm an important part of this community. I'm adding value. I'm taking care of my family. You know, I'm taking, you know, you're not thinking I'm dishonest, right? And if some jerk is back there going, hey, you know, yeah, but you cheated on your accounting, right? No one wants to hear that. So you know, the response, which I only got a couple of responses. And in one case, I had a long conversation, you know, via email, with this internal audit person, and she was clearly angry and felt like I was sort of, I think, what was her word? Like I had trapped her, right? Hey, do you think controllership is important? Have you ever hired a whistleblower? Oh, you haven't? Well, gotcha. You know.
Yeah, you check out the car. Yeah.
So 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 far, I mean, I think that people don't want to hear it.
And you know, I think a corollary to that, on a sort of a macro level, is a lot of the. So we deal with a lot of, you know, compliance offices and ethics and compliance teams, and some of them will kind of pat themselves on the back if they have like a low reporting rate, and they'll say, oh, you know, we don't really get that many reports. And for me, that's always like a red flag, that's a really bad sign. And there's like there's a lot of literature out there on it, some really great articles on it. But it's really a bad sign that you don't have a speak up culture. And I think it kind of can start at the company level. I mean, we're talking about, you know, letting people in the company, and do we blackball them, and do we hire a whistleblower, and is that a scarlet letter on their chest for the rest of their lives? But before they get fired for being a whistleblower, you know, if companies had the right kind of a speak up culture that encouraged this whistleblowing behavior, so to speak, or encouraged people to speak up, I think a lot of these problems would kind of be solved kind of on an organic basis. From your standpoint, what kind of like actionable tips or what kind of actionable perspective do you think we could present to our HR leaders who listen to this, or our ethics and compliance leaders, to help not stifle the voices of these people, these whistleblowers, who, from my standpoint, are usually very like well-intending people?
Well, so I would draw a distinction between various types of things you could blow the whistle on, right? So if somebody blows the whistle and they say, one of our vendors is stealing from us, I'm blowing the whistle on it. Well, the company wants to know about that. That's not exactly blowing the whistle. That's, you know, you're not threatening the status quo. So when the company's doing something wrong versus the company not doing something wrong, those are totally different in complexion. There's another one, which is, you know, the things that matter versus the things that don't matter. Like, you know, John keeps parking in the handicapped spot. Well, John's an asshole, but it doesn't matter.
Right.
You know, I mean, but the CEO, you know, is publishing false financial statements because he's hiding liabilities off the balance sheet, right? Enron. That matters, right? And the way that the company treats the people who raise things that matter is what matters, right? You know, so Sharon Watkins at Enron, you know, raised her hand and she said, I think these off balance sheet, you know, entities are a problem. And she was ignored. And then, you know, and had they, when she first raised it, addressed it, it may not have caused the, you know, the liquidation of Enron.
It may still be around.
Or Anderson, right. You know, but instead, but when finally she raised her hand again, she went straight to the CEO. The CEO, literally his first call was to their outside law firm, Vinson Elkins, saying, how do we get rid of her? Right. I mean, it is, you know, so she has said, look, if the company has a culture where you listen to the whistleblowers, you're going to stop the frauds before they become too big. This is obviously a good thing, but it's difficult to change. I think that I love the analogy, and I do it. I'm afraid to draw this analogy because I don't want to make it too strong, but you know, like the civil rights, you know, movement, right? You know, there was a time when companies would hire the person that they wanted for the job, and they would hire the most qualified person, and it was based on merit, and it was always a white guy, right? Well, obviously they're better off now where they have more qualified candidates to choose from, right? They've got the white guy, they've got the black guy, they've got the African-American, you know, male and female, they've got, you know, they've got, so it wasn't, you know, in 1960, you know, before the Civil Rights Movement, it wasn't that there was no, you know, smart, hardworking, you know, African-American females. Of course they were, right? So you're better off now, but it was a hard fight, right?
Right.
I mean, didn't want to do it. And the people who were discriminating weren't bad people, right? They didn't, you know, they loved their kids, right? They pet their dog, right? They went to church, right? They were just blind, right? And I think that that's where we are now with whistleblowers.
Yeah, it's kind of a mindset thing. It's kind of to your point, it's a way that people are framing it out. And I mean, if you think about that whole Enron thing, what was driving it? Obviously, it was to make the financials look better. Why? Because they were a public company, because they needed to hit their earnings. They had to keep that sort of short-term mentality. But to your point, if their mentality wasn't this sort of finite, fixed, short-term mentality, but was really sort of a long-term mentality, and the goal was not to just survive next quarter, but it was to be around for the next 50, 100 years, then obviously the view from the top of that off-balance sheet behavior would be like, we got to cut this cancer out immediately.
Right.
But it's like they couldn't see past the windscreen or something. They couldn't see down the road to see that, man, this is super toxic and blah, 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 and what the sort of, you know, far-reaching implications of that was on the going concern that was Enron at one point. And then obviously that rippled out to Anderson and to everything else, right? That mentality shift, though, I think you're right. I think it's a mindset or a framing of the issue. And it seems to be rooted in some really short-term thinking at the top. And how do you change that? I don't know.
Well, I think you're right. One of the things that's interesting about CEO comp now is, right, you can make a lifetime's worth of money in 1 year. So when you say, well, they're only worried about the quarter, if four quarters makes a year, and if you're making $50 million in a year, well, who cares what happens next year, right? I mean, but I don't really think that's what's driving it, right? Because these guys are not saying, I want to get my $50 million and I'm out generally, right?
Correct.
But for me, one of the, you know, yes, change at the top is essential. But change in the middle, I think, to me, is almost more important, right? So at Enron hired the best and the brightest. I worked for GE when Enron crumbled, and, you know, I was working on an acquisition, and, you know, every day we were walking past the barrage of reporters and the crooked E, and it was, you know, it was wild. But you walk through this building, right? And, you know, you could see all these diplomas on the wall, you know, and it's Yale, and it's, I mean, you know, they hired the best and the brightest. They hired smart people, right? So, yeah, and there were, I don't know how many employees were there in that big building, but there were thousands, right? There were thousands of very bright people. People knew what was up, right? It wasn't like, it's like Volkswagen, right? Like, what? No one knew that they were designing their cars to cheat on, you know, emissions controls? Of course they did.
It's not like one guy knew. It's not like just one guy knew, right?
Hundreds of people knew. At both of those companies, hundreds. And hundreds of people made the calculation, I can't say anything. Because if I do, you know, then, you know, my kids can't go to private school anymore or whatever, right? Or maybe that's what they think. Or maybe what they think is, I'm just not the guy who rats out my coworkers, right? You know, I like my coworkers. This is the team I'm on. This is my tribe, right?
Yeah. And, you know, as bad as it sounds, kind of bringing it full circle, it's not like there's all these stories of like a whistleblower not pushing a broom at some point. Do you know what I'm saying? Like it's like a self-reinforcing thing.
Yeah. And so I think that, but change is coming, right? So the False Claims Act is a uniquely American thing. And it started like in the Civil War, right? Where, you know, there was a general who was cheating the U.S. government, and the U.S. government, you know, paid some soldiers legal fees to fight the general or something. I can't remember the exact details. And then in the Civil War, it was the same thing. There were contractors who were selling kind of rotten horse meat to feed the troops, you know. And so America came up with this thing which said that, you know, if you are aware that the government's being cheated, you can tell the Department of Justice about it, or you could just sue them yourself on behalf of the government, right? And at first, and so the corporate powers sort of fought against that program every time it's come up, and then it comes up again. And the most recent time it came up, the Department of Justice was very resistant to it, right? They would say, we don't need these stinking whistleblowers to help us do our job, right? We can find these things. You know, we don't need these stool pigeons who are, you know, want to get rich. And there's a, you know, there's a famous 60 Minutes episode on the False Claims Act where the DOJ lawyer basically said, we got no help from that guy, right? And that guy told him everything, right? You know, but that has changed, right? So now, you know, last year, the False Claims Act was responsible for recovering $3 billion for the government. And that's been true for each of the last 10 years, right?
There you go. I mean, there's proof right there. Those are dollars.
Yeah, and that's capitalism, right? You know, if you want to find fraud, you can either hire some people to look for a needle in the haystack, or you can look in the sewing kit, right?
Right. I like that analogy.
Yeah. So my area is tax, and tax hasn't gotten there yet. Because in tax, the whistleblower can't proceed for the government. The government has to do all the work, and the whistleblower kind of is on the sidelines. And I think for that reason and others, it's been spectacularly modest in the amount of money that is recovered. Right, last year it recovered, I think it was $600 million, which sounds like a lot of money, right? I mean, $600 million, except that the amount of money that the government knows isn't collected because of tax cheating is between $300 and $450 billion. So we're talking about like 0.1%,
right? Right?
It's you know there's way more people cheating on their taxes than defrauding the government in government contracts. But on the government contract program, the recovery is $3 billion. On the tax one, it's $600 million. There's some structural things that are preventing the tax program from being successful.
Right.
But I'm optimistic that'll change.
So pulling that down into sort of your regular, small or medium sized business, it's got 5,000 employees, it's got 20,000 employees. What kind of, just to brainstorm a little, what kind of tactics could they sort of pull down from, you know, the False Claims Act or from some of these best practices to, you know, eliminate effectively the need for this internal audit, right? Like, what can they do to sort of, because I mean, look, we're in a capitalistic society. It's probably going to be something capitalistic based, some kind of incentive to promote this type of thing. Like, what kind of actionable things do you think we can do to help elevate these folks to really make that impact on their organization to move from this check the box function that a lot of them are treated as? Unfortunately, right, a lot of boards look at ethics and compliance as a check the box, just like in manufacturing, they look at safety as a check the box. You know, we got to talk about it. Every meeting, we start our board meeting talking about safety, but, you know, everybody's on their phones, right? Like, nobody really cares about it. What do we do to help kind of change that other than, you know, get people like you in the driver's seat, so to speak?
Well, I think that a good argument is compliance functions are overhead, right? And you know, if you the most we want to reduce the overhead. We'd like to reduce the overhead cost of compliance functions. And if you get the information directly, that's more efficient than hiring somebody to ferret it out, right? So it should be more efficient to empower people to speak up. In addition, you know, we do the you know, it's part of the culture that we want more information more timely, right? And so I think that the machinery of capitalism will work better when there is less fraud, and there'll be less fraud when fraud is certain to be uncovered. Let's say that there was 100% reward for fraud, right? I mean, I don't care what the reward is, right? Because as soon as you start paying that reward, then fraud gets uncovered. Then people know fraud's going to get covered, and fraud declines, right? So
it's inevitable, right?
You're not going to, you know, it's not like, oh my goodness, now all the people reporting on fraud are going to get rich. No, fraud's just going to decrease.
Yeah, and I think the underlying assumption that kind of goes without saying is that the fraud is happening. There's nowhere that it's not happening. There's no organization of any size I mean, unless it's just one guy, because he can't, because he technically can't steal from himself. Like, I just feel like any organization, it's going on at some level.
I don't know if that's fair, but it is certainly common, right? Every single week brings another major fraud story. And, you know, I mean, the accounting firms work very hard to preserve their reputation for integrity, and they're involved in scandal after scandal after scandal, right? You know, deferred prosecution agreements, you know, what you know, PwC and this, dictator in Africa who stole all the money, right? KPMG and tax shelters, right? I mean, all of the accounting firms get involved in these scandals, and people who work at those firms know about those issues. And it's the same with literally every single company that I've worked for. I have put my hand up about an issue, but in some cases it didn't really matter. So at one company I worked for, I was on a phone call. It was a regular phone call for this team's meeting. And some guys were in Europe and some guys were in different parts of America. And we get on this call, and one particular call, I actually wasn't on this particular call, but I heard about it. And on this call, they said, "Hey, Charlie, you there?" I didn't answer because I wasn't. "Hey, so-and-so from the UK, are you there?" Nothing. "Okay, so it's just us in the home office. So we'll just terminate the call." And somebody speaks up and they go, "This is John. I'm here." And they're like, "Who are you?" And this is a regular call. So what it turned out was that the CFO had hired a professor to listen in on all of his team's meetings, and he was writing a book, right? You know, My Contribution to World Wisdom by the CFO. Mm-hmm. And the professor was writing it. So the professor one day was busy. So he asked his son to do it. And the son didn't know that they were doing something nefarious, right? Secretly listening to other people's phone calls. And so I said, "Come on, this is bullshit, right? You can't secretly listen to people's phone calls. Well, for one, we're lawyers. You're waiving attorney-client privilege. You know, what are you doing?"
Right.
And by the way, it's scummy. It's wrong. Don't do it.
Right.
Anyway, so, you know, nothing, you know, I didn't get retaliated against. You know, there were a whole bunch of people who said, "Don't raise this issue. It's futile, right? What are you just making people mad on purpose?" I'm like, "No, man, come on." You know,
it's crazy, right?
You got to call somebody on that, right?
Yeah, right. The pitch is in the dirt. That's not a strike, right?
Yeah, right. You know, it's like somebody shows up to dinner without their shirt on. You go, "Hey, dude, you do wear a shirt." Nothing bad happened because that was one of those categories where it wasn't like the head of the company was cheating on something and the company was getting an unfair advantage, right? It was just somebody doing something stupid that they shouldn't have done and they stopped doing it.
Right. But, you know, part of this is just kind of your personality. And as I've kind of gotten to know you a little bit, you're just going to speak up. You just seem kind of wired that way. Is that kind of fair to say?
I think that's the way whistleblowers are wired, but I don't, you know, as we said before, there's a spectrum, right? Because when I started my career, I loved tax planning. Tax planning is fun, right? Walk into a company, you understand how they make money, and you move some, you know, boxes and arrows around on a chalkboard, and they start paying a lot less tax.
Yeah, like, it's a puzzle.
Yeah, it's a puzzle, and you know, so, and it's fun. I didn't think, you know, gosh, what I'm doing here is fundamentally dishonest. You know, it took a long time to kind of reach that conclusion. You know, when there's a rule in tax that says that, in the U.S. tax rules, it says that if you do something simply for tax reasons to achieve a tax benefit, you don't do it for any business reason at all, then you don't achieve that tax benefit. You don't get the tax benefit, right? If you pay $100 that you wouldn't have paid so that you can get $1 million tax benefit, and the $100 is a cost and there's no business benefit whatsoever, you shouldn't get the $1 million tax benefit.
Yeah, and that's like a fingers crossed principle that's going to guard against people gaming holes in this massive tax, you know, code.
The anti-abuse rule. And there's a bunch of these anti-abuse rules, you know, and it's called the business purpose doctrine. Well, it's completely ignored.
Right.
Like Yeah, I mean, like, that's what the tax department does. They find ways.
It's like the whole purpose of it, right?
Well, I mean, there's the planning side and there's the compliance side, right? The compliance side is paid a third of what the planning side is paid. The planning guys tend to be have a more interesting job, and you know, and there's thousands, tens of thousands of people whose full time job is doing that,
right?
Right. And you know, you generate a power, you know, a 200 page power pitch chart, which has every little step, right? It's all tax driven. The IRS is just getting their asses kicked, you know, excuse my French, right? I mean, they're not winning those cases. You shift all your income to a tax haven. Taxpayer wins every single time, right? You know, it's, you know, Facebook is in court on this. A bunch of the, you know, there's a bunch of court cases on this, but the IRS has just got an abysmal record, right? You know, Facebook says, so, you know, our market cap is $100 billion, and we think that our intellectual property is worth 47 cents, and we're going to transfer it to Ireland for 47 cents, and then all the profits are going to be booked in Ireland. So you cool with that? And the IRS goes, oh, that ain't right. And then they lose.
Right.
You know, people think that the IRS is this big bad thing. It is. Unless you're a major company or a rich guy, in which case the IRS is the weakling on the playground, right? They lose.
Wow.
And they don't have to lose because they can, you know, the guy who works in the tax department, you know, making his 100, 200, 300 grand a year, you know, knows about this $100 billion tax cheating thing, right? Incentivize them to tell the truth. And, you know, sure, some companies are going to get hit with some big, you know, tax adjustments, and then they're going to start complying with the law.
Yeah, it's almost like behavior comes down to like the intersection of like incentives and expected value or cost, right? Like he has no incentive to do it. His, you know, his better expected value is to keep his mouth shut and continue to play the game. But to your point, if there was some incentive switch or some kind of incentive adjustment, then you're going to get a different behavior. It's just naturally going to happen, especially in our sort of capitalistic society. That's all, you know, supply and demand lines that are moving back and forth, right?
Yeah, and if you look at any major scandal, so you find a scandal, and my favorite example is Walmart's bribery scandal, right? So in you know, 15 years ago, a whistleblower told Walmart that they were paying bribes in Mexico to open stores, and so the people in Walmart in Bentonville. Now knew that these bribes were being paid. So they sent somebody down to investigate. Sure enough, they were. So you look at that scandal, but look at any of them, right? What happened to the people who knew, right? What happened to the people who knew about the bad behavior on the part of the company and kept their mouth shut, right? The CFO of Walmart International, the CFO of Walmart overall, the, you know, the CEO of Walmart, these people knew, right?
Of course they knew, right?
Well, of course they knew, right? And what happened in that particular case was that Walmart hired law firms for 30 of its executives. So Walmart was paying its law firm, and law firm, it's 30 separate law firms for 30 executives, and they waited 6 years before they did anything. Then they told the government because they thought the statute of limitations had run. And then the SEC investigated for another 9 years. And then the SEC imposed a fine of something like $280 million. So they paid the $280 million. Meanwhile, the legal bill for those 30 executives and Walmart was $1 billion. They paid $1 billion in legal fees. Now, those executives are either still at Walmart in senior leadership positions, or they retired with a ton of money, right? The guy who was the CEO of Walmart.
They were not blackballed, by the way.
Yeah, they were not blackballed. The CEO of Walmart Mexico at the time went on to become CEO of Walmart America, the stores. And, you know, his last year before the SEC came clean, he got a bonus of like $9 or $12 million or something. And then he went off in the sunset. And, you know, in each of those 30 people, right, the identity of those 30 people is not public, right? But there's some of them who you just know who it is, and there's some of them I know who it is, right? and they all did well, right? So the moral of the story is shut up.
Right? I mean, again, just to bring it back to that, that guy who was pushing a broom. I mean, the guy regretted doing the right thing. It's just kind of a bad, that's mm-hmm. not what we all kind of think in our idealistic view of how the world should work. It's just, it's crazy. But what an example that of what we're talking about. Like, there's no incentive to do the right thing in many of these cases.
Right.
It's crazy.
And I think that the incentive to change the system is everyone gets richer, right? You know, why are Africa and Latin American less successful than America? I would say arguably it has a lot to do with corruption, right? That you know, it's not like Americans are smarter than Africans. It's not like Americans are smarter than Latin Americans, right? It's not like, you know, Africa doesn't have natural resources. It does. They're awesome, right? And so why are they poor and we're rich? Well, we have a better form of government. We've got checks and balances. We're less corrupt, right? We're, you know, on Transparency International's list, we're something like the 25th most least corrupt country in the world, right? So corruption makes people poorer, right? And so if we can eliminate corruption, the corruption that we do have in corporate America, right, the paying of the bribes and such, then the world will operate more efficiently, and we will all have, you know, we will all be slightly richer, right? Capitalism's the thing that it does best is allocate resources, right? The person who can best use the resource gets the resource. They pay the most for it, right? And then they put it to its highest use, right? So capitalism is efficient. It uses resources efficiently. Bribery and fraud decreases efficiency. So, you know, if the government can be persuaded to have False Claims Act type laws that work in tax and in other areas, in environmental and, you know, everywhere where you see problems, then it'll incentivize people to do the right thing without any extra resources being applied, and literally everyone will get richer.
Yeah, I guess this is kind of Econ 101, maybe it's Econ 201, but it just, by its nature, it creates this deadweight loss that is going to somebody's pocket that's sort of compromising the optimal efficiency that this system, this market, whatever we're talking about, could theoretically achieve. Yeah, that's a great point.
Yeah, and I think that that's why, you know, Chuck Grassley is the huge proponent of False Claims Act and other, you know, whistleblower programs. He's a Republican, right? He likes the efficiency of it all. And then, you know, there's something for the other side to like too, right? The Democrats like, you know, people paying their fair share, right? So you've got something which has, you know, a whistleblower reward program has something for both sides.
That's a great point. That's a great point. We can look at sort of both sides of the coin, and it can resonate with, you know, it can resonate with either side. But I guess it that would make sense because at its core, it's right.
You know who it doesn't resonate with is the leadership of corporate America, right? Because if you say, hey, we're going to pay people in your organization to betray you, right? They don't like that idea, right? That's a hard, you have to have staggering amounts of confidence to say, I'm cool with rats. Right.
Or an infinite mindset, or a long-term mindset, I think.
Right. I mean, if you're the emperor, right, and you go out there with no clothes on, and anybody who speaks up gets killed, right? You no one's going to speak up, right? But if you go out, you know, if you have a whistleblower, you know, environment, people are going to say, "Dude, put the clothes on." Right.
Where can people find you? Where can they find you and follow you and get to know you more? This has been a phenomenal conversation.
Oh, thank you. Well, I'm sort of experimenting with LinkedIn. You know, I write these articles on LinkedIn. I haven't created a webpage. I'm trying to figure out how to help other whistleblowers, being a resource to them on multiple things. But I think the most interesting thing is once we can persuade the IRS to operate its program efficiently, then, you know, it takes about 10 years for a tax whistleblower to be paid. During that time, it you know, people have got to pay the bills, right? They got to live. And so funding whistleblower claims is actually a mature industry in other areas, right? Litigation finance is a very, you know, well-established mechanism for funding lawsuits. And in the False Claims Act, there's a lot of litigation finance. In tax, there's not. And so I'm working on doing that.
Interesting. But that would be a really interesting innovation that would actually, to your point, like we can talk about it in theory all day long and hey, let's provide these incentives. But if it takes a freaking decade to get paid, what's the real incentive for me today to raise my hand? A bridge between that and the action that would actually drive these right behaviors is kind of what's needed, I think.
Exactly. So to answer your question, I think that LinkedIn is the easiest way. And, you know, I'm pretty responsive. If people reach out to me on LinkedIn, I'll notice.
Well, I just thank you so much for today. I feel like I learned so much. It's great to talk to someone. You brought like a really fresh perspective to it. And I think our listeners are really going to enjoy this conversation as they're trying to push an actual authentic culture that drives those right behaviors. I mean, you just can't fake this stuff. You can't fake a pure culture. You can't fake right behaviors. It either is happening or it isn't. The values are either on the wall or they're actually being lived out. And the more companies that can start living those out, the more that can start to drive a speak up culture. That's how we can start kind of changing this from the bottom. And as you can kind of help to change it from the top, hopefully we can meet in that middle where that real magic is going to happen.
Yeah. And I guess one thing which I'd like to finish with is I don't want to alienate compliance people, right? I mean, you know, the compliance people are working hard. They're trying to change the organizations. You know, there's people who have gone from being in compliance to being a whistleblower, right? So, you know, they've got a hard job, and me saying, you know, gosh, you should do this all a totally different way is not particularly helpful, right?
Well, I can appreciate what you're saying, and I think at the core, what you're talking about resonates with people because they're seeing things the same way as you are. Right? They're seeing the potential for, hey man, if we can just get this behavior right, or if we can just encourage these things, I mean, at the end of the day, it makes their job easier. And then sort of less selfishly, it makes the whole organization better. But to your point, they're many times in a hard spot. They're sometimes pigeonholed in a culture, or they're the way that they're treated or empowered or not empowered is sort of a function of how they're viewed at the top. So, you know, many times they're just kind of responding to the environment that they're in, to your point.
Yeah. Yeah. You can't, you know, you can make small changes and they're worth making, right? I think that the big change is going to take a little bit of time. It's going to take Congress. It's going to take, you know, but I'm very supportive of compliance people and I'd like to be helpful to them, notwithstanding the fact I'm a little frustrated that they don't, you know, they don't buy into my, you know, everyone should be a whistleblower, you know, shtick. But that's.
But I think it's, you know, this is something that we talk about a lot. There is this change coming. There is this change that I think is happening, whether it's a generational change or it's a mentality change or something, where I think people are tired of the inauthentic words on the wall that don't match the actions. I think people are looking for purposes that are resonant with them and their own purpose. And I think we want, you know, like you said earlier, everybody kind of wants to make the world a better place. Everybody, you know, wants to leave a positive impact or a positive thumbprint on whatever they touch. And I think if there's more of us talking about this stuff and there's more people seeing that, wow, I'm not the only person who views it this way, then they're going to feel more comfortable speaking up and getting back to that spectrum we were talking about. These people over here are going to speak up regardless. The magic happens by getting those people in the middle empowered to start tipping the scale onto the side of the speak up culture or on the whistleblower side, so we can hit that actual tipping point to where it starts reinforcing itself in a positive way versus the negative way that our current incentive structure seems to promote.
Yeah, and I think that in an environment where there's a scarcity of talent, talent might have a little bit more leverage to say, you know, hey, I really want to work in an environment where I'm allowed to tell the truth, right? And if you're a culture which rewards people who tell the truth, then that's the kind of place I want to work. And if, you know, so, I mean, I think that there's a lot of positive attributes to having a whistleblower favorable culture. You know, that if you hire, you know, your competitor's whistleblower, then your competitor can't get away with stuff, right? That's a positive, right?
If you
are the kind of place where people, when they put their hand up, are listened to, as you said, you can't fake it. Right. And so and people, you know, should demand the right to work somewhere where It's not, you know, I mean, they're literally examples of companies that were polluting the water and their employees weren't saying anything. I just can't. I think that that's changing. Right?
I think you're right. Yeah, the time is now. So this is like a, I don't know, this is a phenomenal conversation. I just, again, thank you for your time. Thank you for, you know, no one pays you to write these articles on LinkedIn, but I'm telling you, the more of us that are talking about it, we can really start to drive some change that can hopefully affect these workplaces and affect these behaviors to make this whole economy and this whole world a better place. So thank you so much, Charlie.
My pleasure.